NASA is aiming to send humans deeper into space than ever before, maybe to an asteroid, maybe to Mars. The mission presents a whole new set of technical challenges, though. Engineers are hopeful that an inflatable heat shield, shaped like a stack of donuts, will be the key to landing a large manned spacecraft on Mars. Dr. Neil Cheatwood is NASA Langley's senior engineer for Advanced Planetary Entry, Descent, and Landing Systems. He joins me now. Dr. Cheatwood, great to have you on.
Oh, thanks for having me.
All right, so before we get to the heat shield itself, give us an idea of the range of engineering problems that are required for this mission, which could take place in, as soon as, I guess, 5 or 7 years.
Yes, as far as taking, any vehicle out into space and then bringing it back, there's lots of problems there. Of course, you've seen the recent launch vehicle failure of the Antares rocket back in last year. So just getting them out there is difficult, but I would argue that if you're trying to bring the things back, it's even harder. So, you know, we have to deal with the deep space radiation exposure if we were sending humans to Mars, as an example. But the area I work on is actually when you get to your destination, if it has an atmosphere, we don't want to land on it like we did the moon with just retro rockets, because that means we have to carry a lot of propellant with us, and that's mass, and that means a bigger vehicle than we would have to have otherwise. So what we try to do if we're going to Mars or going to Venus or Titan or any destination with an atmosphere, including coming back to Earth, we try to make use of the atmosphere. But what that means is, our vehicle comes in the atmosphere, it encounters the molecules in our atmosphere, and on the interaction of those molecules with the surface, we generate drag, but we also generate heat. So we have to be able to survive high heating environments. And the challenge then is, how do we generate enough drag to slow down the vehicle we have without generating so much heat that we burn up? And the approach we're doing is being able to expand a heat shield from its initial size to something larger, so we get that large drag and we reduce the heating we see because we're actually decelerating up in a higher portion of the atmosphere.
Well, give us an idea of Mars itself. It's something on the order of magnitude of the size of Earth. So it has, I guess, close to the same gravity, but the atmosphere is very different.
Well, you were right and wrong in what your assessment there. As far as the land area of Mars, it's about equivalent to the land area on Earth, but we have a lot of oceans as well. So Mars is smaller than Earth. It's bigger than our moon. It has about one-third the gravity, whereas the moon has one-sixth the gravity. So we've got a larger gravity well to deal with when we go there. We could decelerate propulsively, but it would take a lot of fuel, like we did when landing the astronauts in the Apollo era. So what we try to do is make use of the atmosphere, as we've talked about earlier. The issue is Mars is a very thin atmosphere. On Earth, the atmosphere density at Mars would be about what we have here at 100,000 feet. And, you know, if you think about the 100,000 feet up is pretty high up. Airplanes fly at the 30,000-foot range. Recent stories about the aircraft that have been lost in the Indian Ocean have raised the point that you can't take the airplane too high in the atmosphere because you don't have enough air to work with, enough air molecules to still generate your lift and feed your engines, et cetera. So we want to use the atmosphere at Mars, but it's a very thin atmosphere. We can't really ignore it, but we can't expect it to slow things down like we do here at Earth.
All right, so this heat shield that you're developing, what are the materials that you use, and how do you test a thing like this?
Well, that's an interesting point. So the materials we use are actually, we're making this thing out of it's soft goods, it's fabrics. It's think of your tablecloths or your upholstery on your furniture. We go to these same manufacturers just with different materials. So what we call our first generation system actually used Kevlar, which is what they make bulletproof vests out of. And we can take that's our structure, and it can handle about 500 degrees F of temperature. So, our entry temperature is going to be much higher than that, so we have to protect that structure with a heat shield. And that consists of an outer layer, kind of like the skin of an apple. That's a tougher material that can handle that harsh environment. It doesn't really knock down the temperature very much, and so we might be seeing 3,000 degrees F outside the vehicle. But we need this outer layer just to survive that heating, and it protects our insulation layers. And those insulation layers work just like your insulation in your house to regulate the heat that you're, or cool in the house, case of a house, whether it's a hot or cold outside. The insulation helps you moderate what you see inside the house, and same thing, our insulation moderates what we see specifically on our structure. So our structure has to handle the entry loads, which can be many G's of force, so a lot of deceleration going on, but that structure can only handle so much heating, so we have to knock it down. So we're using, like I said, Kevlar for the structure. I don't know if you've heard of aerogel. It's some people call it frozen smoke. It's the lightest material ever manufactured by man. It's mostly air, but it's a great insulator, and we can actually get it in a blanket form so that we can use it on these flexible systems. So those are the kind of materials that we've been working with, and our challenge has been to try to push the existing materials in industry to see how far we can take those temperatures, but also can we manufacture those things into articles that we can then tightly pack so that we can sew them on a launch vehicle and then successfully deploy them without having damaged them in the packing process. And then we also are working with industry not just on how to manufacture them, but working with industry and academia to develop newer materials that can take even higher temperatures so that we can even push things further.
Dr. Neil Cheatwood is NASA Langley Senior Engineer for Advanced Planetary Entry, Descent, and Landing Systems. And when you're going to work every day and there's contractors coming in and materials are arriving, how real is this to you? I mean, Congress has to keep going along for many more years before a launch would actually head toward Mars. And, I mean, it's a pretty far-fetched idea at this point, both because of the funding uncertainties and because of the many engineering challenges. Does it feel real to you day-to-day when you're working on this kind of heat shield, and in your case, and some of the other components your colleagues are working on?
Well, you're certainly right about the funding being a challenge. I think that's the nature of the game in all of NASA these days, and probably all of federal government. But yeah, it definitely has felt real since we've started manufacturing these things and building them. Actually, we looked at, we being NASA, not me personally, but started looking at these back in the 60s when I was still a kid, looking at the idea of an inflatable or deployable device like this. But we really didn't have a need for it at that time. We had just we were developing how to get to Mars with the Viking missions, and they were successful in finding another way to decelerate at Mars, and so they said, okay, we don't need to invest in these other things right now. And so, you know, you turn the clock forward another 40, 50 years, and we say, well, hold it. A lot of material advancements have happened, and, you know, maybe we should revisit this idea. And so there have been paper studies and those kind of things. You don't really feel like it's real. But now we've started working with industry, building these articles, testing these articles, moving up in the scale of them, and it definitely feels real to me when I go to work. And it's not just and one of the reasons is I'm not just targeting the human missions to Mars, which are out there, you know, a decade or two, but we can apply this to robotic missions, just like the mission we sent to Mars recently, the Curiosity rover. There we landed about a ton of the vehicle weighed about a ton, and we landed on Mars at a certain altitude, but if we wanted to go to a higher altitude at Mars with that same vehicle, our current technology just won't let us do it because we actually run out of time going through this thin atmosphere. We just can't get our sequence of events done before we hit the ground. So this technology could be applied at Mars. It could be applied to a Venus orbiter. It could be applied to bringing payloads back from space stations. Since we, you know, retired the shuttle, we don't have a way to bring back large masses. So there's different applications for this that are attractive to the agency.
Now, I guess maybe in some ways the history of NASA success and advances have gone along with advances in material science, which I think the general public sometimes doesn't appreciate how much material science and technology has advanced in the past 30, 40 years. How do you keep up with advances in the different fields of materials, of which there might be hundreds or thousands of those materials that come to play all together in a NASA vehicle?
Well, fortunately, I personally don't have to keep up with everything. We have a large materials and structures effort within the agency. At NASA Langley, for instance, that's one of our core areas that we specialize on. And it's not NASA working in a vacuum. It's NASA working with industry, working with academia to develop very low maturity ideas. Some of them are just concepts. Some of them are at the molecular scale. That kind of work is currently going on at NASA and in academia, and to a lesser degree in industry, which is more focused on, the near-term applications. But we have folks, experts in all kinds of polymers and resins, and if you think about Velcro, that came from the Apollo era. We're working with carbon-carbons and boron nitrate nanotubes, all kinds of stuff. So we feel like we have a lot of folks that are either on the cutting edge or cognizant of what's going on in industry and academia on the cutting edge. And that's how, and what we're doing is just trying to bring that all that focused on this specific problem.
I guess there's maybe a two-way street here. I guess what NASA develops or needs to develop may also have industrial application, like the Velcro, which has become ubiquitous, and then things people develop for commercial purposes that, as you mentioned, look useful to bring into NASA. I'm curious about that frozen smoke. Just tell us a little bit more about that before we let you go.
Well, that's it's called aerogel, and NASA's actually used it on a previous mission. You may have heard of the Stardust reentry capsule that came back some years ago, and we had gone out to a comet and actually set the vehicle just in front of the comet as it flew through space and collected what we call pre-coma material. And we collected it in this aerogel stuff because it's largely air, but it's just a matrix of material that's high percentage air, and so it actually turned out to be a great dust catcher as well as a great insulator. That's something that's you're seeing it more and more being used in the commercial applications. Some of our insulations are actually furnace insulation, stuff that would be inside your furnace or boiler, and we're just pushing it to higher temperature extremes in our applications.
So you've sort of developed a cosmic Swiffer or something, I guess you might call it.
You could call it that.
And just briefly, your own background, are you a long-term NASA person?
I've been with NASA my whole career in various capacities. Through the, NASA does a lot of funding of students. So that's one of the big things we do is, as part of getting, STEM education and stuff. We've always, the agency, even before I came along, was always about funding students. And so NASA actually paid me to get my master's and PhD degrees. And so I would, go to the university and take my classes and then come to NASA to work in the summers. And after I finished that, I was hired on as a contractor, an on-site contractor for a few years, and then ultimately became a civil servant back in 97. So, yeah, I've been, I guess I'm long-term. I'm not compared to some folks I know, but, I've been there a while.
All right. Well, thanks so much. Dr. Neil Cheatwood is NASA Langley Senior Engineer for Advanced Planetary Entry, Descent, and Landing Systems. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.